From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an in-depth update on the situation in Ukraine.
The United States condemns continuing attacks by Russia-backed separatists in and around Debaltseve, Mariupol, and other locations in eastern Ukraine, which violate the ceasefire and flout the Minsk agreements. The Ukrainian government reports that Russia-backed separatists have violated the ceasefire more than 250 times since the ceasefire took effect on February 15th, resulting in more than 10 killed and hundreds wounded.
That was State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki at her daily press conference Thursday, as she read a prepared statement on the ceasefire in Ukraine, which began this past weekend. Although she specified that the source of her information was the Kiev government regarding her allegations of 250 ceasefire violations by rebels in the east, she followed that up immediately with this.
The OSCE confirms that ceasefire violations continue and that the Russia-backed separatists continue to deny OSCE monitors access to Debaltseve and other areas. These actions are all contrary to what Russia and the separatists agreed to several times in Minsk.
That left the reporters in the room with the impression that the OSCE observers had confirmed the claims by the Ukrainian government of violations by the Donbass rebels. But upon further questioning, a different story emerged.
On Ukraine?
Yes. You said that there were 250 violations. Mm-hmm. Were they by the separatists or that the total violation by both sides?
Separatists, yes.
Since September.
Since February 15th.
Since Saturday.
250.
So, yes. You have acknowledged before that there have been violations by the other side as well. Do you have a tally of how many times? Is it zero?
I do not. I think one of the challenges we hear and have here, Matt, and obviously I reference the Ukrainian government because they are the ones who have said 250 violations, is that the OSCE, while they've confirmed ceasefire violations by the Russian-backed separatists, they don't have access to a number of these areas. They are the independent evaluator of these violations.
Well, the OSCE doesn't have access to Ukrainian-held positions?
To Debaltseve and some other areas where they can get a sense of what's happening. I have not seen them speak to Ukrainian violations.
Right, but if they're there to be impartial, and if there have been violations, I mean, and you've said perhaps understandable violations because they're defending, your words, that you're defending, I mean, wouldn't it make sense to also have a count of how many?
Well, the OSCE would put out that sort of information. I have not seen them put out that information.
But the information on the 250 is from the OSCE?
No, it's from the Ukrainian government.
Well, that's not the same as the OSCE, right?
Correct, but the Ukrainian, if the OSCE would have access to a number of these areas, they would be able to give their own evaluation, but they don't because the separatists are preventing them from having access.
I'm not sure I understand. Is it the OSCE who is supposed to be monitoring the alleged ceasefire, not the government of Ukraine?
Correct.
So the OSCE you see as a neutral party in this, right?
Yes, as does the international community.
Right. And you see Ukraine as being neutral in this?
I didn't suggest that. Obviously, but Ukraine has a stake in the outcome here.
Exactly. But you accept their figure of 250 violations.
I cited their figure because I think it's relevant information.
I'm not suggesting that it's wrong. I'm just wondering why you're accepting it from the Ukrainian government, who obviously have a stake in this.
If there are violations being thrown out there by the Ukrainian government, then let's talk about that.
What sort of examples of violations were the Ukrainian authorities citing?
Well, I think we've seen a number of them, and we've cited a number of them here as well. I mean, around Debaltseve, around Donetsk and Luhansk. So there are a number we've talked about over the last couple of days.
But is it a specific shelling incident or a specific shooting incident?
Sure, those are all part of it, absolutely.
Are you saying, there have been occasions when rebel-held areas have been shelled, right?
Yes.
Presumably, although we don't have proof, and you called for investigations into doing, but that presumably were coming from the Ukrainian government. Are you saying that if the OSCE had access, then they would be to the rebel-held areas? Then
no, I was suggesting that the reason I cited the Ukrainian government is because the OSCE doesn't have access to these areas where the separatists are violating. If they had access, then perhaps they could evaluate whether or not these are all violations.
In fact, The OSCE reports from the beginning of the ceasefire last weekend until its latest report Wednesday spoke of a general adherence to the agreement by both sides and no apportionment of blame for any specific violations. The OSCE Assembly is set to hold a special debate on its response to the crisis on Friday. The Assembly will hear presentations by Ambassador Ertegrul Apakin, Chief Monitor of the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission to Ukraine, and Ambassador Adam Kobiaraki, Director of the OSCE Conflict Prevention Center, and we will bring you that information as soon as it becomes available. The reliability of Ukrainian reports has been seriously challenged on numerous occasions since hostilities began last summer, with a number of such claims being proven untrue. In the most recent case, revealed last week, the Ukrainian government provided pictures of tanks and troops that it said were proof of a Russian invasion of the eastern part of the country. Senator Jim Inhofe's communications director, Donnell Harder, said what were alleged to be photos of columns of Russian military hardware allegedly roaming Ukrainian territory, which were presented to the Armed Services Committee from a delegation from Ukraine in December, along with a request for U.S. military aid, turned out to be pictures taken during the conflict in South Ossetia back in 2008. As we reported earlier, during last week's marathon 14-hour discussion that led to the ceasefire agreement, Russia's President Vladimir Putin repeatedly brought up the matter of a large Ukrainian army force that was encircled by rebel forces in the eastern city of Debaltseve. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko repeatedly denied that the force was encircled and instead took the position that the force was occupying the city and thus did not need to be included in the agreement. But within days of the ceasefire, it became apparent that the force was in fact completely cut off by the rebels. On Tuesday, the officers of the Ukrainian force had abandoned their posts, leaving their troops in a state of disarray, and soon thereafter, the Ukrainians began to lay down their arms, and by Wednesday had, in the main, left the city altogether. After the retreat, Poroshenko continued to maintain that his troops hadn't surrendered, but had simply completed their assignment. For more, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer and researcher on international relations and security at the Center for Conservative Studies at Moscow State University. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Thursday.
Minsk 2.0, this is the agreement that we are told was hashed out last week when Angela Merkel pressed very hard with her little pet poodle Holland, dragged Putin to Minsk. Poroshenko was in the room. The leaders of Donetsk and Lugansk were present in Minsk, but Ukraine refused to allow them in the room or to discuss with them face to face. After 16 straight hours, what they basically came up with was just a rehashed version of Minsk 1 with the vagueness moved from completely vague to mostly completely vague. The big factor that dooms Minsk 2.0 even more than Minsk 1, both the difficulties in agreeing to it in the agreement itself and how it will ultimately fail in its implementation, lie to a large extent in a small Ukrainian town known as Debaltseve. Debaltseve is in the Donbas. It was occupied by Ukraine during their big push last summer on Donetsk. It is a major transportation hub. Railways and highways that connect Donetsk and Lugansk and that connect the Donbas with the out of the Ukraine, both highways and railroads. It is a very important factor for the Ukrainian offensive. It is a big bubble, a big outward push in their lines that attempted to seize control of this and split the Donetsk and Lugansk republics. Now, as a big bulge into the territory held by the republics, it was surrounded and cut off. by forces of the NAF, despite numerical inferiority and largely weapons inferiority as well. This is a repeat of what happened last September before the first ceasefire agreement at Minsk with Ilovaisk, and it is not a coincidence that the cries for a new ceasefire come when the Ukrainian army once again founds large portion of it surrounded, cut off, and facing decimation. Supposedly for 8 hours, Putin tried to convince this putsch president, Poroshenko, the oligarch, the American toady, that his troops were surrounded, and this needed to be taken into account in the Minsk agreements so that humanitarian corridors could be created, they could lay down their arms and safely evacuate behind the line of demarcation to Ukrainian-held territory. He refused to admit this for 8 hours. Putin comes immediately out of the Minsk agreements and says that, well, this is, you know, does not look good simply because of this default of a condition. These troops immediately need to surrender in order for to have any chance for the ceasefire to work, because inevitably they are cut off from supply, ammunition, food, medicine. They will try to break out, and when they do, they try to cross NAF-held territory under arms, of course they will be fired on. Right? This is a huge tactical and operational advantage for the NAF. They're not simply going to give it up.
Right.
And at the time, the Ukraine had absolutely refused to evacuate the Baltsevo because it's so important both strategically for them, but also in terms of domestic propaganda,
right.
With this increasingly fragile Poroshenko-led regime, is facing a lot of unrest, not only from normal citizens who don't want their sons and daughters sent off to be killed with the mass conscription, but also from the these ultra-nationalists and fascist battalions, these paramilitary, who are extremely upset about the way that the war is going and about any talk of peace.
Right.
So as a result of this, immediately after the ceasefire was supposed to take effect, of course, during that the previous day, and night, the Ukrainian forces made at least five attempts to break out of the Debaltseve cauldron, which Poroshenko tells us does not exist. They were repelled every time under heavy fire, and then the NAF leaders said, okay, you've attacked us here. This isn't, there was no provisions made for this in the Minsk agreement. Wherever the Minsk agreement is held elsewhere, we will abide by it. The OSCE has already confirmed that in Lugansk, the militias have withdrawn their weapons in accordance with the Minsk protocols. But in Debaltseve, this situation, sorry, has to be fixed. And there's nothing in Minsk that covers it, so we don't see any reason why we shouldn't. So Debaltseve, during 3 days of the most horrific and heavy fighting, the Ukrainian forces were driven out. There were, we don't know exactly the death toll and the numbers that have been taken prisoner. The Donetsk Republic officials say that that the Ukrainian military has lost 3,500
right.
troops.
I saw that.
There are still several thousand that were actually trying to escape south, further, closer actually to Donetsk territory. Those are doomed if they do not surrender. There is a second, a large number of other troops still trapped in what is basically a second pocket north, the retreat to Artemovsk. And the situation is terrible. I've seen the pictures. I've heard firsthand accounts. This is some of the most grim and brutal fighting. And again, it was largely a slaughter, unfortunately. And it is really a crime. And the crime is that the regime in Kiev has so little regard for their own people's lives that for the sake of their absolutely absurd propaganda, that they would let these people die, that they effectively abandoned them. They had no hope. They had no chance. And they were simply, some cases they were told to hold, and some cases they just weren't given any orders at all.
The reports were on Monday that essentially the officer class had fled, and there had been, laying down of arms and surrender by groups of hundreds of the troops, and then a pronouncement from Kiev that this would be treated as desertion with the appropriate legal responses, which, as we know, means you lose your property and you get shot. So that was, and what's kind of interesting to me, the error that Kiev is making, given the Nazi inclinations of the right sector and those, upon which Poroshenko relies for power, these are the same errors that Hitler made against Russia back in World War II.
The parallels are eerie, and there's a lot of parallels. We're looking at the anniversary of the date that the Soviet flag was flown over Stalingrad with the victorious cleaning out on that. Right. Exactly parallels the date in February this year when the flag of the Novorussian Armed Forces was flown over the Baltsevo. And if you take a look at the pictures, they're in very similar condition, and as horrific as that is. I want to, if I could, stress something for the American audience. You have to understand that this regime is pursuing this war, on one hand, with these paramilitary battalions, okay? These are the Maidan fanatics, the ultranationalists, the fascists, the true believers in the new Ukraine, Ukraine that flocked, that overthrew the government and then flocked to join the battalions to subjugate the Donbass and Crimea to the rule of this new regime early on. And they did keep this regime in power. They're still keeping it in power. The Ukrainian ambassador to Germany just said yesterday in an interview to German TV, when he was asked to explain how the Ukrainian government, such as it is, can allow these people, knowing what they are, so openly espousing their ideology and symbols, these fascists, how they can justify it. And the Ukrainian ambassador said straight to their faces that they are absolutely essential. Without them, we would have already been defeated. Wow. So they are part of our defense forces. There was nothing else said there. Mm. That the other part of why they're able to continue this war is the Ukrainian regular army itself and mass forced conscription. The Ukrainian, this Kiev regime is on the fourth wave of mass forced conscription right now, with two more waves calling up another 100,000 people scheduled in the next few months. Right. And when I say mass forced conscription, this is men, women, and even pensioners from the ages of 18 to 60.
Right. There were two refuseniks that were famous soccer players in their late 50s.
Yes, Soviet heroes of the soccer field. And who are coaches of the local teams, football teams in the Donbass. And they've been quite vocal about it, that they're refusing. There's also a journalist by the name of Katsuba who wrote against mass forced conscription. He's been charged with high treason and has been basically abducted by the regime's goons.
And then, of course, so the first wave of this second wave, in other words, you have three waves that were supposed to go this year, began in January. It was announced in like mid-January. And by January 31st, the regime itself had announced that it had files to prosecute 7,500 draft dodgers at that point. And that was supposed to be a 30 or 35,000 person call, so almost a 25% noncompliance that was identified already.
Yeah, all the numbers are that it's actually much higher than that. people are trying to escape this conscription, okay? They don't want to be sent into cannon fodder. Many of them don't want to fight for the regime, and they certainly don't want to kill and be killed for it. So when I say forced, they are often picked up literally at gunpoint from shopping malls, from cafes, at their homes, nightclubs, wherever they can be found, on public transportation, right? Because the recruitment officers go around with these right sector and other battalion paramilitary to find conscriptions and to send them to the Eastern Front, and literally. And if they don't comply, they're threatened with 5 years in prison and probably a beating, and possibly, you know, we don't even want to talk about what else they could suffer at the hands of these fascist, brown shirts. But further than that, once they're conscripted, the Ukraine has adopted a resolution to allow for summary execution of deserters on the battlefield. Wow. This is reported in Newsweek, right? Even the Western mainstream media took note of this one, although it just barely didn't touch the narrative. So we've got mass forced conscripts, tens of thousands of them, and they're being threatened with death, right? There are reports of that in Debaltseve that the paramilitaries were basically set up as barrier units, and several we'll consider it unconfirmed, but several of the captured POW, the conscripts, report that they were fired on when they tried to retreat.
So I'm in my early 60s, and with my clothes on, I look like I'm in my mid-50s. So I'm at a mall, and some military and SS or brown shirt guys patrol the mall. They see me. They figure I'm draft age. They cart me out, and now I'm in the Army and subject to summary execution if I leave. That's the deal?
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how do you get a force that is working under those conditions and with irregular supplies, pay, and such to go kill their fellow countrymen aggressively on behalf of a regime you didn't elect?
Okay, well, the tactics are that originally, last spring, when they first tried to take Donbass, the tanks and the APCs of the Ukrainian military were met as they came into the villages by crowds of the local people who surrounded the vehicles and said, what are you doing here? We don't want you here. We don't need to be liberated. We don't accept this regime that has come to power. What are you doing, military, here? And largely, the soldiers were shocked to find that the local people say this, because they've been fed something completely opposite by the Kiev regime and Western propaganda outlets that echo it. So they were disarmed. They voluntarily stepped down. This is where the NAF first started being able to take and field vehicles and started forming their own resistance force. So in order to stop this, because it happened repeatedly all across the Donbass,
all summer,
they stepped back and they moved to the tactic of just bombing the cities wholesale from a distance with artillery. So that many of the conscripts have no idea who or what they're firing at. They're being fed a completely different story from the reality on the ground. And when they're taken prisoner and shown videos or taken through the streets of Donetsk and Lugansk and seen the horrors that they have done to the civilian population and to the city there, many of them break down in tears.
Right. I've seen this. Let me ask you a question. Is this a hearts and minds strategy? What the hell is Kiev thinking by doing that?
These people that have come to power in Kiev, they are largely from the West Ukraine or possessed of this extremist ideology where they regard the genocidal Nazi collaborator Stefan Bandera as their national hero, their national hero for their conception of what Ukraine is. Now, Bandera, aside from being fully complicit in the and eager even in the genocide of Jews and Poles across Ukraine, he more poignantly, the only thing he loved more than that was killing East Ukrainians and ethnic Russians in East Ukraine. And the massacres and the atrocities against them were just as bad. The people of East Ukraine know this, of course. Right. And the idea that they're presented by a regime that tells them that their national hero in ideology should be of the guy that was massacring their grandfathers.
Yeah, as they start enacting the same legislation, withdrawing, yes. Pulling the language down, no yes. use of the language in the schools, etc.
Yes, it all comes together. The people in the East Ukraine said, "We're going to have none of this," this has all led to where we are. So the people in this regime can't really be considered as rational actors, I do not believe. They are fanatics. Poroshenko's refusal to admit what happened in the Baltseva moves from domestic propaganda through sociopathy into outright clinical insanity. All right, yeah. Somebody please get this would-be emperor some clothes. Or someone tell him that he's walking butt naked, covered in blood through the streets of Kiev.
Well, politically, he couldn't do it. I mean, they were not happy with him being in Minsk in the first place, right?
No. There's these battalions, 17 battalions in the right sector, which is funded by this oligarch warlord of Dnepropetrovsk, Kolomoisky. They have set up an entirely different headquarters and command structures separate from the Ukrainian military in the last few days. There have been more than a dozen occasions in the past year when they have threatened to come back to Kiev and storm the Rada or the Ministry of Defense. And quite often they have actually formed large crowds, set up top burning tires and tried to batter their way through in the doors. And each time the regime, knowing that it depends on them to retain in power, both symbolically and literally as muscle, have given in to their demands. So there's the question not only of how much control does Kiev actually have over many, thousands of its own forces, but who's really in charge? Yeah. Who holds the real power in Kiev, if they have to keep giving in to their own paramilitaries, which even Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have accused of gross war crimes and crimes against humanity. The right sector outright threatened that just foregoing to Minsk to do to Poroshenko and his family what was done to Gaddafi. Now, right. Again, we'll consider this unconfirmed, although these sources I trust. Poroshenko's family was immediately flown out of Kiev right. and evacuated to Germany. Right. Now, they haven't been, of course, the government denies this, but they also haven't been seen in public since.
And also, some of the members of the senior parliamentary members of Poroshenko's bloc, their families too, from what I read.
Oh, yes. It has to be remembered that there are a lot of members of this Poroshenko bloc and the others that are just oligarchs, Western complicit neoliberals, but also probably some actual genuine, very naive and misguided liberals who want to make Ukraine into a kind of a kitschd version, a second colony of the EU with this EU association agreement. But there are also a large number, probably about half at this point, of nationalists, ultra-nationalists, these outright right sector fascists in the Rada at this moment. Many of them are former paramilitary battalion commanders.
Right.
There's some real crazy extremists in there that routinely physically attack yeah. anyone who dares try to even question what's going on the Rada floor.
Yeah, they beat them. I saw that.
They've beat the head of the main Ukrainian TV channel just for showing a speech by Putin on when Crimea was reunified with Russia.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.